But begin to read Mark's Gospel, Mark chapter 1. And I'm just going to read a couple of verses, first of all, from the early part of Mark chapter 1. And then I'm going to read the final bit, a final little story. But I want us to get a context for the story that we're going to read. And therefore, just a couple of verses, verses 14 and 15, first of all. And it says this, that after John was put in prison, Jesus went into Galilee proclaiming the good news of God. The time has come, he said. The kingdom of God is near. Repent and believe the good news. That's Mark's introduction, if you like, to everything else that is going to happen, that we're going to read about in this account of the life of Jesus that we call Mark's Gospel. So we carry that on now in verse 40 of Mark chapter 1. A man with leprosy came to him and begged him on his knees, "If you are willing, you can make me clean." And filled with compassion, Jesus reached out his hand and touched the man. "I am willing," he said. "Be clean." And immediately the leprosy left him and he was cured. Jesus sent him away at once with a strong warning. "See that you don't tell this to anyone, but go. Show yourself to the priest and offer the sacrifices that Moses commanded for your cleansing as a testimony to them." Instead, he went out and began to talk freely, spreading the news. And as a result, Jesus could no longer enter a town openly, but stayed outside in lonely places. Yet the people still came to him from everywhere. This is the word of the Lord. Those of you with long memories may remember that I had the privilege of being here and sharing a service with you earlier in the year. And as some of you will know, I very much try, as I visit the different churches, the different congregations around this Northwestern Association, which goes as far as Tawin. That's the Tawin with a Y, not with an R. Down in Mid Wales, right up to Carlisle, up in the north of Cumbria. I try to sort of find myself saying, you know, what is God saying to us as a community? What is God saying to us in this diverse group of congregations, some of whom will be so small this morning that they'll be sitting in a little circle, others so big that I sometimes have to introduce different people to one another and they discover that they go to the same church because I know them, but they don't know each other. Some of them in some very beautiful, idyllic places like Snowdonia, others in some quite tough inner city communities, and an incredibly diverse set of situations. And the question I keep asking myself is, what is God saying to us as a people and as a community? And I think the thing that's been on my heart, and interestingly, it was renewed for me again, even as we prayed this morning in the vestry together, is that I believe that God is calling us again to be a community of people who share Jesus, who make Jesus known within those communities. And it seems to me that that's something that we can do. You know, if the six of us and we're together and we're meeting in an inner city community, then we know how that community works because we live in it. We know what makes it tick. We are those who can share Jesus in that context, just as in a community like this one, where we wrestle with issues of identity and language, and we seek to share Jesus in a way that makes sense to the community around us. You know, as Baptists, we've been having some enormous debates and discussions over the last few months about the decisions that churches should make on their own and the decisions that we should be making collectively. And when those decisions are decisions that not everybody agrees with, inevitably the debate gets a little bit hotter and people begin to talk about our declaration of principle, the fact that every church is independent and yet interdependent and such like. But you know, it's interesting that what we forget so often is that enshrined in our identity as Baptists, in all our diversity, enshrined in our identity is a final bit that we often overlook, that it is the duty of every Christian believer to share the gospel with those around them. Now, the word duty, let's just remember this was written kind of way back in the good old days. And maybe that word duty is not the right word to use in a modern context. But the idea that we are called to share Jesus, we are called to make Jesus known. And I find it quite amusing that in a job like mine, I think probably because I've got a suit and a tie, that people often think that my job is to kind of be the Baptist thought police. You know, if someone thinks their church isn't doing it properly, whatever it is, they kind of send for me. I get these fantastic letters sometimes of complaint. Got a letter of complaint once from a lady that lived next door but one to one. She didn't go to it. But she lived next door but one to one of our churches, and she wasn't very happy. And one of her complaints was that people were coming out laughing and smiling. I said, I'll have a word with the minister, see what I can do to stop that, you know. I can think of, no, let's not go there. What is it? What is it that we're called to do? And I think one of the things that we're called more than anything else to do is to share Jesus. And here's the thing. I don't think we're doing it very well, if I'm honest. Now, that might sound a bit critical. I'm not coming here to criticize anybody today. But I think, you know, I kind of look and I see and I get those figures that tell me year on year, actually, there's less of us than there were last year. I've got more experience of selling churches than I have of buying them, thanks to Penrach for being one of those that we had to learn how to buy them. But it's just rare, if I'm honest. We're more used to selling them. And if you think about it, the population of this country is growing, or these countries is growing. And the church is just about staying the same, and we think that's good. If the population's growing and we're staying the same, it means we're shrinking. And therefore, it does seem to impress on me, without coming here to be miserable and criticize everybody, is to say, you know, what are we doing to share Jesus? And as I reflect on that, and you heard me talk about this when I was here last time, I'm not going to try and labour it again, but I used the image of the from Chester Cathedral of the Jesus and the woman at the well, a story from John chapter 4, and just looking at the way in which Jesus reaches out to this woman. Jesus seeks to enable her to encounter who he is. And I want to carry that theme on a little bit today. Because it seems to me that we've never, for all the fact that we're in this kind of struggle, as it were, to reach the population. You know, I mean, Wales is one of those places, particularly, if we're honest, where we recognize that. There's so many disused churches that once were packed, or so many churches that are three quarters empty that once were packed. We're not reaching people in the way that we used to. And yet, we have more resources, more ability. I mean, I can sit in my living room and I can put something on the interweb and the internet. And you know, within 5 minutes, someone in Australia can take issue with me for saying it, if they're awake. And because they're asleep on that side of the world, women, just in case. But, you know, we've got such incredible opportunities, and yet we struggle to connect people with the message of Jesus. And I kind of, as I look at that and as I reflect on that, I find myself asking this question, whether we're actually relying too much on, not that any of these things are wrong, but on our kind of techniques, our courses, our events. We're great at doing events. But as I look at the scriptures, as I look at the New Testament, it seems to me that the early church didn't do a lot of events. They tried once to do some food distribution and ended up having an argument between the Greeks and the Jews, and took seven blokes to sort it out. That's seven blokes just to make sandwiches. That says a lot, really, doesn't it? They weren't particularly good at doing events, but they seem to be brilliant at sharing Jesus. And what's incredible is that most of those people, the places they were sharing Jesus in, they were sharing Jesus in those places because they'd turned up there as refugees, because they were fleeing from persecution and from all kinds of stuff that was going on. And yet, for all their lack of resources and their lack of understanding and their lack of experience, there was something about these people that they just couldn't help but share Jesus. These people were like an infection. You know, wherever they went, other people started to follow Jesus, which was particularly annoying for the people who were persecuting them, to be honest, which is why, you know, let's go into it because I'll be here all morning. But we're not like that anymore. And what I want us to do is to just spend a few minutes this morning looking at this one particular story from the stories of Jesus from the Gospel of Mark, and just stopping and thinking for ourselves, well, what can we learn from that? What does that teach us about the way in which we are called to share Jesus today? Because I want us to recognize the fact, you know, we often talk, don't we, if you're familiar with these things, you'll know this, that we often talk about what we call the Great Commission. And we're very keen on remembering that at the end of the gospel narratives, at the end of Mark, the end of Matthew, the end of, well, not the end of Luke, but the beginning of Acts, because I'll go into that some other time. But that at the end of the story, Jesus kind of turns around to his disciples and his followers and says, go into the world, go and tell people about me. Go and spread the good news. Go and proclaim the gospel. But what we perhaps don't always recognize quite so easily is that actually that commission to share the gospel doesn't just come at the end of the story, it comes at the beginning. So it's not that, you know, Jesus comes and he dies on a cross, and we'll talk about all this when we come to communion in a little bit, and he kind of deals with all the mechanics of sin and everything else, and he sorts it all out, and then he goes and says, go out and share that with everybody, you know, like as if this is Newton's second law of physics or something that people are called to share. Jesus actually invites people to join him in proclaiming the good news. Let me remind you again of what we read at the beginning of Mark's gospel. Jesus turns up on the scene in verse 14. After John was put into prison, Jesus comes into Galilee proclaiming the good news of God. The time has come. The kingdom of God is near. Repent and believe the good news. Jesus is proclaiming the good news, not after he has risen from the dead, which he does, but before he even gets to Calvary. Jesus arrives as a proclaimer, there's a cue for a song, of the good news. Don't go there, James. All the way through the service, though, he's going to go, I will walk 100. He might even sing that later. You could probably get away with being in the proclaimer, don't you? It's not, is it? Oh, that's a bit sad. Anyway, we're not going to sing the proclaimers. But Jesus is a proclaimer of the good news. And it's as though Jesus then begins to call his disciples. He begins to call his followers. He begins to call other people to come and join him in this proclamation of God's good news. The whole of Jesus's life is an example to us of how to proclaim the good news. So when Jesus marches into the synagogue in Capernaum, he's proclaiming the good news. When Jesus goes and turns over the tables of the temple traders in Jerusalem, he's proclaiming the good news. When Jesus stands on a hillside and feeds 5,000 people, he's proclaiming the good news. And when Jesus encounters a leper, when Jesus finds himself confronted by a man who's got one of the most disfiguring and disabling and antisocial diseases of the day, and when Jesus responds and reacts to that guy, he is proclaiming the good news. Now, here's the second thing I find interesting about the opening chapter of Mark's gospel. It seems to me, time and time again when we read it, that Jesus seems to be doing his absolute best not to let anybody know that he's proclaiming the good news. This isn't very good for a good, sound, solid evangelical to be saying. But if you look here, it seems that forever Jesus is trying to avoid people. So we've got this situation. He says to Simon and co, come and follow me. And he goes into Capernaum and he casts out an evil spirit. And then as soon as they left the synagogue, they all, we're told, you know, news about him, verse 28, spread through the whole region of Galilee. And then in verse 35 of chapter 1, just before with this story of the leper, very early in the morning, while it's still dark, Jesus got up, left the house and went off to a solitary place. Jesus gets away from it. And Simon and his companions, who are the people who are following him, who are trying to help him and join in this proclaiming of the good news, they come to him and they say, look, everyone's looking for you. Everyone wants to see you. You've become a celebrity. You're well known. You've even got your name on the church notice board. Everybody wants to see you. So Jesus said, well, let's go somewhere else then. And even when this man is healed, if you have a look at the end of the story, he heals the leper. And then he says to him, whatever you do, don't tell anybody. Now, I don't know whether, you know, sort of what's going on here, but it's fascinating, isn't it, that so much of what we talk about today in mission, dare I say, I'll probably get into trouble for saying this, but it's very much about marketing. How do we sell ourselves to people? How do we let people know who we are? How do we communicate what we're about? was it seems to me that Jesus presents us with this completely counterintuitive picture of someone who's doing his best not to particularly broadcast who he is. But there's something so irresistible, something so unsilenceable, something so unkeep-quietable about all, if there is such a word, which probably is in Welsh, then the more he tries, the more people do talk about him and do want to know who he is, because there's something real about him. And sisters and brothers, without in any way being derogatory or being negative about all the good efforts that we put in to making Jesus known, ultimately, if what we are is not real, if what we have is not real, then we'll never sell it. We'll never market it. And we can't make up for not being real by marketing ourselves well. And so I just want to take a few minutes this morning to return you to that desire that we are those who make Jesus known. Because I believe the only way we'll make Jesus known is not by people like me organizing things for others to do or writing great books or running great websites or anything like that. I think it's about when all of us as individuals are so real in our relationship with Jesus and our interaction with others that even if we try not to, people can't help but want to see more of this Jesus. And so I want us to look at this interaction, this very simple interaction between Jesus and this leper. It's told in about three verses because Mark tells his story like as if, I don't know, it's like as if he's got 10 minutes. Mark writes his gospel the way I used to write the last sentence in my exams at school. You know, kind of, you know, when your teacher said, just finish the sentence you're on and then put your pens down. And you realize that's why commas were invented, because you've still got 20 minutes worth of writing to do. I haven't finished the sentence, honest. It's the longest sentence in the history, but well, I think Mark wrote his whole gospel like that, because the whole thing is just, this happened, that happened, Jesus went there. And in a couple of verses, he just said, look, Jesus, he met this leper, and he said, if you want to, you'll heal me. And he reached out his hand, and he touched him, and he said, he healed him. And then, move on, next story. That's the way he tells it. And yet, even in that glimpse, we see something. And I, being a good Spurgeon's man, I want to just draw out three things. The first is that we see something of Jesus' motive for engaging with people. If you look, it tells us here in verse, let's be sure, where are we? There we go. There it is. Yes, we find in verse 41. It says, I don't know what it said on the big board, because I was reading from my bit, but it may say, did it say Jesus was indignant, or did it say Jesus was filled with compassion? Depends which version of the NIV. Filled with compassion. It's an interesting word. It's actually the only bit of scouse, really, that's in the Bible, as far as I'm concerned. It's a Greek word. It's splanknitsos, which is, if you're ever going to learn, I mean, I was always told at college, never quote Greek words in sermons because you're just showing off. But there's a few that are worth it, and I think splanknitsos is one of them. It's good, isn't it? It sort of rolls up. Splanknitsos. You can enjoy that, can't you, on a long car journey, you know, splanknitsos. And it's a word that's not used very often, but it actually means that it's a sort of, it basically means his insides were turned over, which is translated into scouse as he was gutted. You know, a bit like Lovren yesterday when he chipped that ball forward to one of Palace's forwards who scored. He was gutted, as was an awful lot of the rest of us. But it's actually a really good translation, because what it tells us is actually that this wasn't anything superficial. I quite like the word indignant, actually, because the trouble is, and I can understand why the translators don't use that. It's probably a very accurate, if you're a linguist, it's probably a very accurate way of translating it. But it's the kind of indignation, if you like, that you would get. Imagine, I don't know if anyone is an artist or a painter. That is a artist, well, and a painter, you could do a bit of decorating as well. But, you know, if you imagine you've just painted a beautiful picture of Snowdon, for example. That's a mountain just over there, in case you didn't know. And imagine that then you just finished painting it, and you left it on the wall somewhere, And someone came and got a can of spray paint and sprayed it and got a Stanley knife out and slashed it all up. And you did this fantastic job. That's the indignation. That the sent not that look at this beautiful piece of work I've done and it's been ruined. I think that's the kind of indignation, because of course God has created this precious thing called humanity. And here is Jesus confronted by this man whose life has been ruined, whose body has been disfigured, who's living in the stench and decay of this awful disease. And I think we catch a glimpse of God's heart at this moment. The Creator God, who to whom every human being is precious, saw the state that this man was in, saw the state of his life, and he was moved, he was filled with compassion. He was indignant, not with the man for daring to ask for him to heal him, but he was indignant that any precious human being could be in that state. And the first thing I want us to notice is this is Jesus' motive for mission. And we're told that again and again. We're told it on a big scale. You know, that while we were yet sinners, God so loved us that he gave himself for us. And the question I want to ask us today is, do we have that same compassion for our fellow human beings? Because again, it's a very counterintuitive and countercultural thing. Now, I know these things are very complicated and there's all kinds of issues involved, but you know, it's been fascinating, hasn't it? This whole business of Calais in the last couple of weeks and the clearance of the camp and are these people, if they're 18, they look 19 to me, you better not come into our country, mate. But what I find interesting is, where's the compassion in that? You know, the narrative of our society is to be suspicious. The narrative of our society is to look after your own, to be protective of who you are, to build up your borders, to guard yourself. And I'm not pretending any of this stuff is simple. But what worries me is that those values and those narratives rub off on us. And we become naturally critical. You see, this was a society in which this man would not have only been disfigured with this awful illness, but he would have also had to live in isolation and separation. He would have been told that every time he ever saw another human being, his job was to get away from them. Imagine having to live like that. But just in case you think that's bad enough, also people believed at that time that if you were disfigured in that way, if you were ill in that way, you must have done something to deserve it. That was how people thought. And so they'd look at this guy and they'd not only think, oh, poor bloke, he's in a bit of a state, and I better not touch him because he might be, but also they'd say, and he must have done something a bit dodgy for him to be punished like that. That was how people felt. And Jesus breaks through all of that convention. And Jesus says, forget all that. Forget all those narratives. Forget all that rubbish that I've been told. I see a human being. I see someone who has been consumed by all that's gone wrong with my creation. And we can apply that spiritually as well as physically, because we're told that actually at the beginning, this would go right back into the early narratives of our faith, that God made the world and it was perfect and it was beautiful and everything was great, and then sin came into the world. And again, that we forget that that's you know, that people hear that as the church being very critical and condemning of people. But it says, you know, the whole physical order got messed up. And that's why, not as a punishment, but just as a consequence of that, the kind of mess that this guy represented. And Jesus doesn't see this. This is the key thing for me. Jesus doesn't see this as a marketing opportunity. You know, Peter doesn't whisper in his ear, Simon as he was known then, and say, you know, hey, heal him, that'll get the crowds in. Or Jesus doesn't see him as, well, you know, this guy will be a good fight. If I heal him, then, you know, take him round and show people, make me famous. There's no opportunism in this. And Mark tells us that for all his rush. He says, look, before you go anywhere, there's no opportunism here. This is about compassion. And so what of us? How do we see our fellow human beings? If we are going to share Jesus the Jesus way, I think the first thing we need to be is a people of compassion. The second thing I want us to look at is Jesus' methodology. Because this is the second counterintuitive thing that Jesus does. He reaches out his hand and he touches him. Now, if he'd have been told, feel bad about lepers, well, you're right. If you want to feel bad, that's okay. But whatever you do, you don't touch them. And not only that, but Jesus, you're trying to set yourself up as a rabbi. Well, you haven't been to a very good rabbi school. No one's ever heard of you before. You suddenly turn up age 30 and claiming to be a teacher sent by God. At least try and look like a rabbi. Rabbis do not, ordinary people may accidentally, mistakenly brush against a leper, but actually rabbis keep their distance. They keep their distance and keep their distance and keep their distance. And of course, equally, we would know, because we're clever about these things these days, because we understand things like immunology and diseases and bacteria and all that kind of thing, that there were good reasons why you wouldn't touch a leper, because it was a highly contagious disease. But Jesus reaches out and touches him. And again, there's a massive challenge there for us today. Are we a people where our reputation is more important to us than the people we're seen to mix with, the people that we're seen to reach out to? And if you think about it, there's a kind of naturalness to all of this, because if, as a human being, if you feel compassion for someone, what is the most natural thing you're going to do? You know, when a friend suddenly turns up on your doorstep and bursts into tears, what's the instinctive thing you do? The hint's in the hand movement, by the way. You'll give them a hug, won't you? You'll reach out, you'll touch them, you'll take their hand. You'll, in some way or other, you will engage with them physically, because it's kind of part of what it means to be human. So there's something very natural about this, and that's my point. That if you feel compassion, you reach out and you touch. And then you've got the third thing, and Jesus said, "I am willing, be clean." Now, what amazes you about that? Well, I get, for most of us, we would sit down and say, well, come on, it's obvious what amazes us about this, because this is leprosy, this is the incurable, this is to this day a disease that really, okay, we've learned a few ways of dealing with it and handling it and all the rest of it, but it's still here with all the advances of modern medicine, and Jesus heals him, for goodness sake. That's amazing, isn't it? Well, let me suggest to you, that's not the most amazing thing in this statement. And he said, "I am willing, be clean." Because Mark's got one message. Mark's got one key desire. And that is to convince us that Jesus is God in human form. Okay? Because you've got to kind of bear in mind that Mark's audience know about the cross. They know that Jesus was crucified. None of them doubt that Jesus lived, because it wasn't that long ago that he was in the papers or whatever the equivalent was at the time. The key thing that Mark wants to convince his readers of is the fact that this bloke, Jesus, who everybody knows about, everyone's been talking about in the press and in the common conversation, was God. And I could take you through the way time and time again in his gospel, no one can forgive sins except God, and Jesus forgave his sins. Who is he that the wind and the waves obey? All the time, he's asking the question, who is this guy? Who is this guy? He's God. Now, let me take you back again to the early part of Genesis. Genesis is quite poetic, particularly the beginning bit, okay? And it was probably written originally for kids to recite in school, a bit like they did their alphabets and stuff, And on the first day, God said, "And it was so," and it was evening and morning. The first day, you could imagine all the kids recited it in Hebrew, couldn't you? And there's kind of a rhythm to it, isn't it? "And God said, and it was so." Where's Pumpkin Man? There he is. Yeah. "And God said, let all the seeds come out." And it was so. Yeah, that's what you were referring to. Yeah, he's just making sure there. That rhythm is there in Genesis, isn't it? "And God said, and it was so. And God said, and it was so. And God said, and it was so." Now, if God has turned up on the scene and is confronted with a leper, and God says, "Be healed," what do you think is going to happen next? It was so. Spot on. You're on the case. And actually, if you've just made the whole of creation out of nothing, sorting out a bit of leprosy is hardly a big deal, is it? If you think about it. For you and me, it would be. To me, what is most amazing is about those three words that precede it. "I am willing." The God who can speak into being this universe. The God who just has to say it and it happens. Can look that individual that most human beings would write off as an absolute waste of space, as a nobody, as someone to be avoided, and say, I am willing. You know, there's a lot said about the fact that Jesus says, I am this, I am that, I am the other in John's gospel. But it's pretty amazing that in Mark's gospel, he says, I am willing. Jesus' message is, I am prepared to put myself at your disposal. And I dare to say that whether we are a church that can command miracles or not, if we're a church that's willing to say, I am willing, let God worry about the miracles. Let God worry about the signs and the wonders and all the rest of it. Let's just be a people who say, I am willing. And that to me is that simple. Jesus says, look at me. This is how I proclaim the good news. Look at my motive, pure compassion. Look at my method, which is to reach out and just engage and be real and live it out and touch the untouchable. And look at my message. God is here at your disposal. And I want to invite you, just as we close, to put yourself in the shoes of the leper. And I realize that as a group of people, we're all going to be very different. Some of us, you know, we're so much part of the furniture of this place, we couldn't imagine it functioning without us. Although some of us may have just popped in today to find out what this place is all about. But just put yourself in the shoes of that leper for a minute. You've been told for most of your life, for as long as you can remember, that you're a nobody, that you don't belong, that you're filth. That if any other human being comes near to you, you have a moral obligation to keep away from them. Go and live on the margins. Ideally, just disappear. We don't want to know you. And you get to hear about this man, Jesus. You get to hear a glimpse of hope in these crazy stories that are emanating from disturbed synagogues in Capernaum and strange stories down the pub or whatever it is, and suddenly you find yourself in front of him, and you do. Now, I know you can do it. And for the first time, for as long as you can remember, another human being deliberately reaches out and touches you and says, I am willing. Be clean. The first thing I want to say to you this morning is, if you think that there is anything about you that means this God cannot be bothered with you, cannot be interested in you, that somehow or other this is all a bit untouchable for you, then let me assure you that that's not true. Just look at this leper. And if you're part of the furniture, then if someone like that came banging on the door of our church here, is that the message? Is that the message that they'd pick up? Would they see in us something of that Jesus who reached out and touched this guy? Because that's the Jesus that we're called to share. That's the Jesus that we're called to make known. And in a few moments, we're going to share bread and wine together. Because it's a costly business, this Jesus business. We find the same Jesus 3 years later on a cross. Because people couldn't deal with this kind of behavior. But as we come to this table, we receive both welcome that says, yeah, I'm willing, come and be clean. But we also receive commission that says, come and be part of sharing this good news with our world. Yes, we need our clever communicators. We need our courses. We need our programs. We need our activities. But if the heart of them is not a people who have the same compassion and the same willingness that Jesus had, then they'll never quite deliver for us. And equally, we may sometimes make a right mess of it. And if you're one of those people that's been on the receiving end of us making a right mess of it, well, forgive us. We're not asking you to follow us. We're asking you to follow Jesus. And he doesn't. But when we're real, even with our faltering, failing mistakes, God can be seen. Let's come into the presence of that God afresh as we prepare ourselves to share bread and wine together.